Welcome to the California Sun Podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Scheckman. Today we turn our attention to the streets of San Francisco. Embroiled in a relentless drug and overdose crisis that has marked the city's deadliest year on record. The saying goes that one death is a tragedy, 1,000 deaths is a statistic. This chilling perspective has become all too real in San Francisco as policy debates and election promises continually fail to address the root of the crisis. This week, we speak with Matthias Gaffney, a journalist for the San Francisco Chronicle who has painstakingly documented a particularly devastating week in San Francisco. During that week, 24 individuals succumbed to drug overdoses, turning what might have been a normal week into a tragic showcase of the city's ongoing struggle. Gaffney's story, San Francisco Overdose's Deadliest Week, does more than recount these losses. It brings to light the human stories behind the grim statistics that haunt the city's conscience. From the steps of the California Supreme Court building to the sandy dunes of Ocean Beach, these were not just numbers, but individuals. A recent immigrant dreaming of a new life, a star student and athlete, a mechanic trying to outrun his demons, and many more. Each person's story reflects the complex interplay of drug use, mental illness, and the often elusive search for rehabilitation and the deep systemic issues fueling the city's drug crisis. Despite various actions taken by city and state leaders, including declaring a state of emergency in the Tenderloin, the tide of death has yet to be stemmed. Gaffney's article underscores the importance of understanding the lives affected by this crisis in the hope that their stories can lead to meaningful solutions. It is my pleasure to welcome Matthias Gaffney here to the California Sun Podcast to explore the depths of San Francisco's deadliest week and to illuminate the stories of those we've lost and the urgent need for action in a city grappling with an unprecedented epidemic. Matthias Gaffney, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, it is a delight to have you here. Talk a little bit about the evolution of this project. This wasn't something that was easy to do, to dig through the lives of these 24 victims.
Yeah, so I would say about halfway through 2023, the numbers were looking pretty awful, that frankly, we would probably have a new record amount of overdose deaths for 2023 in San Francisco. And at that point, my editor came to me and said, we're just about to get a bunch of data from the San Francisco Medical Examiner's Office. That would include, you know, date of death, time of death, location, name, how cause of death, those basic information. And from that, let's try to find out what the deadliest week of the year has been. And let's see if we can find out who those people are who passed away and find families and friends to, you know, put some faces, put some stories behind these awful numbers. And in the end, you know, we picked this month in early March that had 24, which is obviously 24 deaths in a week is just horrific. In the end, it wasn't the deadliest week in 2023. You know, we had gone so far in talking to families and friends that we weren't going to change the week. But sadly, there was even more death in weeks after that.
One of the most tragic parts of these stories is the way in which so many of these people died. So many alone or on the streets or in a restroom somewhere. Talk about that and the impact that it had on you as you dug deeper into this story.
Yeah, it was of the 24, 19 died alone. That really stood out to me. And so that's one statistic that was not captured in this data we got from the medical examiner's office. So once we had that data, I asked to view the coroner's reports for all 24. And that provided the autopsy report, which is very medical, includes their toxicology reports, for instance, any underlying medical issues that they had. But more importantly for me, they included the coroner's reports, which is basically the deputies provide some context around a death. You know, there was maybe drug paraphernalia nearby, and that helps determine whether it's an accidental overdose, a purposeful overdose, etc. And so once I got a hold of those, I started taking my own internal statistics that weren't provided with our other database. And that was one of the first things I wanted to record is, did they die alone? And for some reason, that just really stood out to me as a powerful part of this message. It spoke to mental health. It spoke to the dangers of doing drugs alone. It spoke to this core kind of gut sadness that it brought to me when I just found that most of these people were alone when they passed away. And so, yeah, 19 of the 24 died alone. And, a lot of that probably is a consequence of being alone. If you're with someone else, there's a very potent antidote to fentanyl and other opioids, which is Narcan, and is very effective at reversing an overdose. And if these people are alone, there's no one there to administer Narcan. So that, just kind of in a very simplistic way, is probably why a lot of these people were alone when it happened. But it also hit on just the fact that, I talked to some experts who said, when you're this deep in addiction, it's hard to be with others. Other people have struggled to be your roommate. Other people struggle to be your brother, your sister. It's difficult. And it's just it starts multiplying. If they're not allowed to be around you, or they're not feeling comfortable being around you, or vice versa, that just accentuates and propels mental illness, loneliness, which could further push them to use. And so that was just a really key statistic I felt like to stress in the story.
One of the other statistics, and there were so many, but one of the others that's so shocking on a certain level, is that there was one of the deaths that you reported that was in a hotel room, an SRO, a single room occupancy, where others had died of overdoses before.
I know. So that was something I got those statistics late. We got a bunch of data going back from the medical examiner's office to like about the pandemic when it started, 2020. And that provided me a wider range of dates. And on those, I had all the addresses. And so I started to look at the 24 people who died, and I looked at the SROs where they lived, and to see if they had similar deaths in previous years. And so, sure enough, three of the 24 were staying in the rooms where people had previously died before of overdoses. One individual was actually staying in a room where a 22-year-old woman had died just 10 months earlier. And others lived on floors that had multiple deaths. So that, you're right, that stood out to me too, where I was just it that really kind of is shocking to me that these tiny little rooms that are a lot of these people's last resorts to get a roof over their head has seen so much trauma in so many recent years.
And one of the other facts about all this, one of the other aspects of it, is the degree to which so many were unhoused and others, even though they may have had shelter, still suffered.
Yeah, it was. I think we had about a little less than half were unhoused, and a lot of them, we only had so much information. Obviously, we spoke to a number of families where we got more detailed about people's backgrounds, but other people, there were a lot of people who I just could find very little about other than the coroner's report, and so it was difficult. But we did our best to determine whether they had a roof over their head at the time of their death, even if they're on the street, if they still had housing, perhaps. And yeah, so nine of them had no housing, and so they were found in parks, or one was on the beach. There was another struggle with this story that the wider database didn't cover, and it can actually, we found it probably is warping a lot of the data that's out there on where people are dying, for instance. And that is because a lot of people, for their place of death in the medical examiner's office, they are listed at hospitals. And so a good percentage of people who overdose make it aren't declared dead at the scene, and they're taken to a hospital. And so if they then pass away at the hospital, that is determined to be their place of death. So it's only by going an extra step to seeing their coroner's reports, can you trace back to, okay, well, where did they actually overdose? And some overdosed at their in their SROs, some overdosed in their encampments. And so that gives you like the true picture of the housing situation. And yeah, it's you know, incredibly depressing throughout the city. People on the streets who are passing away just on the corners.
Tell us a little bit about the individuals and what you discovered with respect to the families that they had, relationships, people around them, or lack thereof.
Yeah, I mean, this story in many ways is about obviously these 24 souls who passed that week, but it's also really about their families, because there are way more than 24 victims in this story. There's the amount of suffering that it was so raw for so many people. Many people didn't want to talk to me because it was still so raw. The ones who agreed all wanted to try to help other families and going through the grieving process, or helping kind of coping with just living with someone who's on the street or who is using. You know, one of the first people, just, it was kind of odd, and just in going through the story, one of the first people, the first person of the 24 who passed away chronologically was this immigrant from Romania, Ion Pop. And I just happened to get a hold of his friend first. And so just that was the first story I kind of learned. And it was just, you know, a tragic story of someone coming, immigrating to the country with, you know, these grand thoughts of what life would be with a young family. And it just all fell apart very quickly, and unraveled so rapidly. There's just trying to think of these other families all stood out so in their own ways. It was kind of interesting late in the story. I got this estranged wife of one of the victims almost in the last few days before the story published. And that was, I was trying to track down photos for some of the people who I hadn't reached, family and friends. And so I reached out again one last time just to see if I could get at least a photo from people. And I found her mother, who sent me to her daughter, who was married to Mr. Watkins, and she was open to talking. I hadn't found her the first time I tried for families. And she told me just this tragic tale. He grew up in San Francisco in the Tenderloin, and his parents were addicted to crack. And he grew up, you know, as an 8-year-old trying to score crack for his mom. He winds up smoking crack cocaine himself at age 12. And you just start thinking of trying to put that into perspective in your head about what type of life goes, what type of life someone who's interspersed in that type of a household that young, how can you get outside that cycle of drug use? It's just monumental when you think about it. And then, you know, spoke to family of a guy who was going to go to Columbia. I have kids who are looking to go to college, and, you know, obviously Columbia is a great university. He got their full ride on academics, walked on to the football team, was just this golden child of his family, and then starts hearing voices, and his mental illness just cratered, and he left school. And it's just a lot of those stories are why we did this, frankly. It's just we've all heard the numbers. We've all walked through San Francisco, and you've seen on the corner someone crouched over. You've seen maybe drug paraphernalia next to them. And maybe you cross the street to the other side. Maybe you change your BART seat. And I don't think the average person thinks about who these people really are.
There is this perception sometimes that the problem on the streets derives from economic circumstances. But in fact, if you look at these stories, in so many cases, in most of them, I would guess, that mental illness plays such a significant role?
That seemed to be a common thread through all of this. And again, I had limited information. I didn't have medical records. I didn't have official diagnoses. In some of the medical examiner reports, it mentioned official diagnoses, so that made it easier. Some of the families told us of their own. Others, there were hints that there probably was something, but so we were careful with how we kind of came up with the number of people suffering from mental illness. But clearly, there was a significant amount, and a lot of that weaves in and out of the drug use, the mental illness. It can spark the use of drug use. Drug use can spark the mental illness in some instances, experts were telling me. But yeah, it only adds to oftentimes what isolates the individuals who are on the street or who are using. It's just as the experts were telling me, you know, it creates an incredibly difficult person to not only treat psychologically and as far as medically, it creates this dual diagnosis. And one of the families, their son suffered from addiction and from severe mental illness. And they said they just could never get treatment for both. It was kind of one or the other. You get treatment for his addiction or you get treatment for his mental illness, but never the same. And because of that, one thing he would finish his treatment and one thing would almost certainly lead to the next, and he would be back to square one. And that's one of the biggest chasms that we have to overcome somehow.
Also, there's the sense that so many of these families at one point tried to help, but it exhausted their resources, both physically, mentally, and economically.
Yeah. I mean, for sure, the Terrys, they estimated they spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to try to get their son treatment. And they fully acknowledged that is a unique circumstance, that most people suffering from these deep addictions do not have that type of support. But it illustrated just even with all the resources, both parents, all the money that they could throw at the problems, still their son wound up dying of an overdose. So it was pretty daunting. And that is, as I spoke to the experts, very much the exception to the rule. Mostly a lot of these people are going at it themselves, whether it be financially or support system around them. So that's a lot. That's a lot to overcome to get someone out of that spiral.
How much of the blame for the deaths, for the overdoses happening with such frequency, lies at the doorstep of fentanyl as a drug?
Yeah, I think it. You know, there's been drug use through time. There's been scourges of different types of drugs. But fentanyl is a very unique foe. It's, as one expert told me, you're dealing with a historic foe. This is kind of the deadliest of the deadliest. We've had, obviously, other drugs can kill you. You can overdose. There are overdose victims in this 24 who died of cocaine, for instance. So it's not to say you can't overdose from others, but you need so little. There's so little room for error. There's so little room to go from just having a hit off of it and dying. There's very little room for error. And so I think that's what changes the dynamics here, in that it just takes so little. So, you know, that means you don't have to buy that much. That means that you can very easily, depending on the purity, you can miscalculate very easily. So that's really a challenge. And I don't know what the answer is to that. With supply out there, if there's going to be people with the demand, there's going to be a supply.
Did you see anything in each of these stories, anything that ties them together that lends itself to saying, okay, we can look at all of this and the solution is here? It seems to me that when you look at all of these, there's still a lack of clarity in terms of how to deal with all of this.
I think frankly, I came away almost feeling like it was more daunting than when I entered it. Mm. I came into the story with a unique approach. I mean, there's a lot of people who report on San Francisco and the fentanyl crisis, homelessness. I have very rarely reported on that. I'm an investigative reporter who covers a lot of different things. I just hadn't, just by circumstance, I guess, hadn't really touched on that topic. So it gave me in some ways a unique perspective. And I don't know, I kind of came in thinking, I mean, you're asked to write a story about one of the deadliest weeks in the deadliest year. I don't think you're expecting to come away, you know, feeling with a happy feeling at the end of that. That being said, I thought there might be more optimism than I did come away with, because it just felt so daunting at the end. There was so much complicated nuance in what everyone was facing, you know, where I just, I don't know. When I spoke to experts, they kind of told me, yeah, oh, this is not something that you pass one ballot measure and all of a sudden people are off the streets and sober and everything's back to normal. This is like a decades long slog where you have to marry a bunch of different systems together, which politically is a whole nother thing. It's fraught politically to reach that consensus, where you have a balance of between, you know, safe consumption versus, and along with treatments, to get something like that type of web that needs to exist, that they believe would help, is going to be daunting. And even if you do, you're still going to have death. This is a very dangerous drug, but you're going to start to see numbers drop, and it's just going to take time.
Is that the answer to part of this, to at least get as much of the fentanyl off the street as possible?
That's, getting the fentanyl off the street is the, I suppose, in a lot of ways, the million-dollar question. How do you do that? What over time, you know, we've had a war on drugs. And we have drugs still. It's how do you get these drugs off the streets if there's a demand there? There's definitely one side that wants to attack the source of the drugs, the people who deal it. Does that stop it? Will someone else crop up and do it if other people are put in jail? It's a really tricky question. And I don't know if I came away with the right answer. I think the experts who are much more knowledgeable about the situation would tell you that it's going to take a combination of things. It's going to get fentanyl off the street is not as simply as just cutting it off at the source. You're going to need to get rid of the demand too. It's got to happen on both sides, and that's not going to be easy.
There's also, as we talked about a few minutes ago, there's the mental illness component and the chicken or egg thing that plays out here, that the drugs become a kind of self-medication for the mental illness, but at the same time, they're aggravating it.
Oh, absolutely. Mental illness is an incredibly large component of this. As I said before, it's got to be a combination, is what I'm told by the experts. Many of these people have mental illness and drug addictions, and you can't just treat one. If you treat one, the other will rear its head, and both will be back in play very shortly. That's easier said than done. John Terry, one of the people I profiled and spoke to his family, he was going through, as I said, he had a lot of support from his mother and father. And he was, as he began using and spiraling in San Francisco, he began to get in trouble criminally. And so he wound up, and he was kind of using in the criminal system, he was in behavioral health court, which is a system that allows it tries to divert people from jail or prison and into mental health and substance abuse assistance. He was going through that. His parents wanted him out of San Francisco. They wanted to bring him home, but he had to. He had these criminal cases that were lingering. He had to get through behavioral health court, and he died 2 weeks before he graduated. They literally, 2 weeks after he died, his parents went on Zoom and heard his name get called as he graduated from that program. So, you know, those are the type of programs that are probably needed, but even when you have them, it's no guarantee that people will come out of it alive.
Is it your sense that if policymakers were doing what you did, really learning the personal behind the stories, behind the numbers, behind the statistics, that it would make any difference, that it would shape policy in a different way?
That's a good question. I get very cynical when it comes to politics. That being said, it certainly couldn't hurt. I think everyone on these issues are so polarized on one side or the other that what gets lost is the human carnage, the human beings that are at stake here. That's not just, I'm not just talking about the people who have actually fatally overdosed. There's so many other people impacted by it. And I think oftentimes when we're debating it, and when especially when politicians are debating it, they're looking at numbers, they're looking at other things, elements of the issues other than their who these constituents are who are actually facing the biggest implications, the people who are dying, the people who are sending their kids in these neighborhoods, the people who have friends and family who are intertwined in these issues. And yeah, so I think learning about who these people are, I mean, I think frankly that was at the core of our mission behind this project, is to find out who these people are, find out how they came to San Francisco, find out what programs or what they were trying to do to get help, what maybe help was lacking in certain places. But more than all that is to just remember, like, remember the humanity throughout it all, because that's going to set us in the right direction if we keep that at the core.
And finally, Matthias, talk a little bit about how it affected you. I mean, I know for the reader of this, it's a very grim tale. It's very powerful and in parts hard to read. Talk about how the reporting on this impacted you, and more importantly, how it affects how you will look at the city and look at these issues going forward in the reporting that you do.
Yeah, it got pretty personal. I mean, it's difficult as a reporter. I mean, I knew coming in, I was going to be reaching out to 24 grieving families, and would I want, if I was in their shoes, would I want a reporter to cold call me and ask if I wanted to probably talk about the worst moments of their lives? So that's daunting going into it. And once I reached people, to be honest, like they were very accommodating, even the ones who declined. They understood where we were coming from, how we wanted to kind of put a face to these statistics. And I got to know these families pretty well. I mean, I tried to spend as much time. A lot of them were out of state. And so I got to talk to them over the phone for many hours, hearing them cry. As they recalled those moments that they get a call from the medical examiner's office crying about how they just can't find courage to actually have a funeral because they just never had any closure with their kid's death. It was a lot. And I remember after the story published, one of the moms sent me a really nice text, but you know, her surviving daughter is also in addiction, and she said, you know, thank you for doing that. I'm now dealing with my daughter who just was brought back to me by police the night before for getting beaten up by the people she was hanging out with. And now I'm dealing with her and her addiction. And so, you know, in a lot of ways that snapped me back to reality of, you know, this is, again, going to be a very challenging time for everyone. But as far as how I'll look at the situation personally going forward, you know, I go into the city to work in our offices at Fifth and Mission, and there are people who are suffering from addiction all around there. I had a colleague who recently brought someone back from an overdose using Narcan. So it's in many ways on our doorstep there at the Chronicle. You go day to day and everyone loses a little bit of the humanity. And now you're seeing someone crouched over in front of a bank ATM, and you're not just seeing another piece of this awful story. You're thinking that's someone's son, that's someone's father, perhaps that's someone's grandfather, perhaps. And they had a life, they have a life, and it's worth figuring out a solution to this, because it's just too tragic to let these lives slip by.
Matthias Gaffney, his Chronicle story is San Francisco Overdose's Deadliest Week. Matthias, I thank you so very much for spending time with us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you for listening and joining us here on the California Sun Podcast. I hope you'll join us next week. I'm Jeff Shackman. If you like this podcast, please feel free to share and help others find it by rating and reviewing it on iTunes, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.